Welcome back to the Ogilvy Day Stage. We're here all through South by Southwest Interactive with the best in book authors around technology, about marketing, about life, about building stuff and making a difference. We are going to close out today's sessions, and we hope you'll join us for the rest of the show. We kick off tomorrow. We'll be running all day with Jonathan Fields. He returns. This is his second time on the stage, actually, since I've been here. We're happy to have him back. You may know him for a career renegade, making a great living, doing what you love. A previous book. He's here to talk about his new book, Uncertainty, which turns the notion of uncertainty being a bad thing, but it actually being fuel for brilliance. And it draws on research, personal experience, neuroscience, to understand how uncertainty can actually reveal changes, help you adapt the way you work, to fuel new ideas, solutions, and innovations. We're super psyched to have him back. Everybody, warm South by Southwest welcome for Jonathan Fields.
Thanks, man. Hey. Are you guys good if I jump down off of this? Because I can't stand like being elevated above people. So as long as you don't get too much feedback, I'm just going to kind of hang out here and walk around. Sole survivors of the first day in here, so congratulations. Who's actually been to South by before? All right, a lot of you. Who's first time? Right. So if you're first time here, you're like, oh my effing God. Yeah, it's an insane amount of people. I've been coming for a while now. I want to take you back a little bit. I know I have to be careful with speakers. I used to own one of the larger yoga studios in Manhattan, and I started in 2001. And we were coming into the end of the first year of running this business, and we did gangbusters. I signed the lease for that business on September 10th, 2001, the day before 9/11, and all sorts of craziness ensued. We ended up still opening the business, and it turned into a really powerful experience for us as a business standpoint and also for the community. And has anyone ever owned a business? Cool. So one of the incredible things that you learn is that the first year of owning a business is actually not the hardest year, the second year is. Because the first year, it's brutally hard, but you're running on adrenaline and hope and spirit and love and vibe. And the second year, you realize, oh my God, this is a business. And you really have to dig in and figure it all out. So I kind of sensed that coming. And I decided that this was also a seasonal business. And I needed something to sort of bring attention and give it a big shot, a business opportunity. So I decided that if I could connect the style of yoga that we taught in this company and taught with some big mass commercial movement, that it would be great for the business. And also on a bigger scale, I could get people doing something in their lives that would really be profound. So I kind of figured, well, if I could show that this style of yoga burns a lot of calories, that would be pretty cool. So I reached out to the head of the performance lab in Adelphi, and I said, are you interested in a study? And his first answer was, not too interested. He's like, yoga, isn't that what your like grandparents do? And then I convinced him to run a pilot study on me, and he's like, oh, that's yoga. So we brought a whole team of people out there. We ran the study. The results were tremendous, but that wasn't really what I was doing it for. As soon as they gave us the yes for this, I said, okay, I'm going to reach out. And I reached out to the five top fitness editors of magazines in the city. I said, we're doing the first ever study on how many calories yoga burns. Do you want in? And I said, the first person who says yes gets an exclusive. So the then fitness director at Self Magazine said, totally, count me in, I want this. And she said, can I be a participant also? I said, I don't know, we negotiated it, she was a participant. Numbers came back great. And just letting her in was a huge risk for me. Why would it have been a huge risk? Right, because if the numbers came back terrible, we're busted, right? But the numbers came back great. So that was the first big risk. Now, the second one came when I promised something. So once the numbers came back, she's like, it's great, Adelphi signed off, you can release the calorie number before we actually publish the academic paper. She's like, cool. She calls me about 3 months before an article is about to be put out there. And she says, you know, we're writing this thing about this, and it's tremendous, and the headline's going to be Yoga Torches Calories. Killer headline, short thing, we're mentioning you, we're mentioning the whole thing. But it's too bad, because you have a local brick-and-mortar business, and we have 5 million or so readers for our magazine, and nobody's going to have access to it. And I said, you know, that's really funny. because we literally just wrapped post-production on our first ever video. She said, really? What's it called? I said, Vinyasa Heat Live. She's like, how much is it? $19.95. Where can people get it? At the website, which, by the way, we had just started building. And she said, that's fantastic. We'll put it in the magazine. So I hung up the phone. I turned to my partner. And I said, we need to make a yoga video. At which point, you know, this was not the first or the last of many slaps in the back of my head in that relationship. So we made the video. That video literally came in on a pallet the day that the magazine hit the street, and a couple thousand sold out like that. That launched a media division of this company that then had a much bigger reach, where we released a series of different experiences. So my willingness to go to that place where I was willing to make a public commitment and completely put everything on the line. I had never done a video. I'd never used a video camera. I had never gone through the production run, the back end of it, the licensing, the artwork, the design, the recording, nothing. I knew nothing about this. But I knew that if I did this, there was astonishing opportunity on the other side, both to impact a lot more people than I could reach with my local business and to grow my local business exponentially because of that. So I went to that place where I had no idea how it was going to work out. We could have crashed and burned. But I knew it was a place that I had to go also, because the opportunity was so disproportionately greater than the possibility to crash and burn. And what I started to realize from that point and over a period of years since then, through my own business ventures, that business was sold at the end of 2008, and through consulting with different companies and having the opportunity as an author to interview literally hundreds of creators across literally every creative field, from hackers to designers to, you know, painters to musicians to CEOs to entrepreneurs, founding teams, is that a lot of our ability to succeed at the big things, to grow really cool things in the world, to create something from nothing, has to do with how we perform, not every day, that matters, but during a series of moments in time, a series of pivotal moments in time. Now, I call these crux moves, and it's a term that comes out of rock climbing. Any climbers in the room, by the way? Yeah, so crux moves. If you climb, the base of the climb to the top of the climb can have all sorts of varying degrees of difficulty, but the climb is usually rated in difficulty based on the one or two sequences or moves that are the most complex. Those are the crux moves. How you handle those moments in time is largely determinative of how you handle the entire journey and whether you succeed or whether you crash and burn. It's that way in business. It's that way in any creative process as well. You guys may have experienced that. There are these moments where you have got to take action or make decisions that move you into this place where you don't know how it's going to end. But you've got to act. Because if you don't, then you end up either going sideways or slowly, slowly drifting down. And that's not really what we're here to do. Now, in the tech entrepreneurship world, there's one word which has sort of exploded as the common word which defines these moments in that world. Does anyone know what that word would be? Disruption is all around us. Disruption is the new black. So we're looking, what? Almost, pivot. Pivot. So it's like what's the big word in tech entrepreneurship these days? It's pivot, right? Companies who are open to the notion that it's almost universal that the vast majority of the assumptions that you make to start your business are going to be anywhere from a little bit wrong to dead wrong. Usually it's closer to dead wrong. So we start any company, any venture, with a whole set of assumptions, and we build plans around that, and we work. And as we work, we start to replace assumption with data. And as we get more data, that data usually proves that most of what we assumed was dead wrong. And then we hit that crux move. We hit the pivot move. And our willingness to say, you know what, all that stuff that made me feel good because it was, you know, I thought it was real, it was hard data, and that's what I'm acting upon. It's fueling me, it's giving the mindset to take action every day. All the data is now showing me. That is not just guess and assumption, but the data is now showing me it was all wrong. I need to pivot the model, the business, the product, the service, the team, potentially everything, if I want this to survive. It terrifies us. Has anyone been at that place in a business in here? probably a whole bunch of you, right? It is not a fun place to be, but it is an incredibly powerful place to be. If you approach this as an opportunity to say, screw it, what got me here ain't gonna get me there. The beautiful thing is, now I'm making this decision to make a radical change in what I'm doing based on a lot more data rather than pure assumption, pure leaps of faith. It's still a scary place to be because there's still a lot we don't know, and we have got to take action and take steps in the face of great uncertainty. That's part of any creation process, is decisions and actions without having perfect information, without knowing how it's going to end. We have to go to that place repeatedly. And in those crux moves, where they're the really big moments, those are the places where it's the most important to actually step out and trust that the steps will appear as you do that. But there's a problem with that. So that's mandatory. By the way, what's the only way that you could actually know? What's the only way that you could know, have perfect information before you took the next step? Only two ways. You've already done it, or somebody else has already done it. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm not interested in starting something that I've already done before or that I know my friend down the block has already done the exact same thing. I'm not here as a replicator or a duplicator. I'm here as a creator. And I think that's why most of us are here at this festival, because that's in our blood, it's in our DNA. Which means that you have got to own the fact that you'll need to go to that place where you have to take action. You have to make decisions that make you uncomfortable, where you're uncertain. They place you in a state of uncertainty. Because going to that place means that you're doing something that matters, something that's new, something that's different, something with the potential for genuine, original impact. And that's what we're here for. But here's the problem with that. Here's the problem with that. It scares the crap out of us. Nobody in this room, but I'm sure other people outside, right? We're all above that. So why does it do that? Has anybody felt that, by the way? Has anybody actually gone out there? So we have basically like three people telling the truth in the room and 97 lying sacks. No. So yeah, we've all gone there. And there's actually a neurological reason that when we actually go to that place, our brains are softwired. I don't want to say hardwired because we now know about the brain, nothing's hardwired anymore. Nothing is hardwired anymore. But we're softwired, by the time most of us reach adulthood, to experience having to move into a place of uncertainty as pain, as suffering. The amygdala in our brain, the sort of the seat of fear, literally lights up, sending a cascade of hormones through our body that make us physically uncomfortable. Fight or flight response, for anybody who's sort of, you know, heard that phrase before. They make us want to do something to not feel that way. So what we do is generally one of two things. Either we shut down, we become paralyzed, we stop what we're doing, we kill the project, we kill the vision. Very often, by the way, we don't realize that that's why we're killing it. We make up a rationalization that says, oh, well, the data isn't supporting it anymore, or the team member left, or the competitor is doing it better, or different, blah, 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 blah. That's our blah, blah, blah response, and we all have it. Because we don't want to own the fact that we're killing it because we can't handle being in this physiological state anymore. Or we do the exact opposite. We actually rush so fast from the place that we are to try and get finished because we just want the feeling to be over with that we ignore so many possibilities that would have presented themselves had we been willing to sit with this feeling and move a little more slowly and a little more deliberately and look for these things. You know, there's an interesting sort of mythology in the world of goal achievement, which is that, and a lot of you guys have probably worked on this level when you're trying to build something. You set a goal, and the more clearly defined it is, the more likely you are to actually achieve it, and the more efficiently you'll get from point A to point B. Has anyone ever heard that? Does anyone operate by that rule? A lot of people do. Well, here's the thing. It is very likely true. That's the plus. What's the downside of this? The downside is that while you may very likely get from A to B more efficiently, what you will miss by focusing on that and only that are all of the opportunities that presented themselves had you been willing to take off the blinders. And instead of getting from A to B as fast as possible, you would get from A to Z a little bit more slowly, but you would have exponentially more impact, bigger company, bigger solution, whatever it may be. fascinating study by Richard Wiseman, who was trying to figure out, is there something about people who are lucky? And what he did was a really cool experiment. It blows me away that this isn't just urban legend. He took two groups of people, people who self-identified as being really lucky and people who self-identified as being really unlucky. He sat them down with a newspaper, and he said, count all of the pictures in the newspaper. So it turns out the people who are self-identified as being unlucky, as a general rule, took about 2 minutes and came up with 42 pictures. The people who felt that they were all very lucky, on average, took a few seconds and came up with 42 pictures. How? How is that possible? Well, it turns out the inside front cover of the newspaper, written in 2-inch block letters across the entire top of the newspaper, were the words, stop reading. There are 42 pictures in this newspaper. The people who self-identified as being lucky, which were, and they did that because in life they tended to always do amazing things. Things came to them. It turns out didn't have blinders. Even though they were told to complete a specific task, they stayed open to the possibility that there were all sorts of opportunities outside of that linear thing that might present themselves that might make this much better, much cooler. Interesting sort of subtext to that. He repeated the experiment but changed it to say on the front, stop here and you'll get $200. So there are a whole lot of luckier people after that variation. So what do we do about this? If we're sort of softwired to run from this thing that we need to run to in order to create great things in the world, what do we do about it? Are we just screwed? The answer is yes, we are. It's not. So what do we do about it? Well, there are a couple things that we can do about it. And because we're kind of like, how are we doing time-wise here? Cool, all right. I'm gonna shorten it to one or two. And if you guys have more questions, we can sort of play with some questions after this. So what we discovered is that we are, in fact, softwired to not want to experience this thing. But we can train ourselves to become much better at being in that place that we have to be, being in that space of uncertainty long enough to create genius. Two things we're going to focus on. One is something called mindfulness. And it's a word that's been sort of bantered around for a long time. It's a 2,000-year-old practice. Depending on tradition, probably more than that. And it's a form of this spooky, woo-woo, kooky, bizarre, naked, chanting cult thing called meditation, which you don't have to buy into. The beautiful thing about a mindfulness practice is that it's a very simple practice where you just sit and observe your breath. The instructions are gorgeously simple. The practice is actually a little bit harder. Has anyone actually experimented with this? Yeah. Okay, keep all of your same hands up. Who found it really easy? All hands go down. Yeah, what's kind of fascinating is that for anybody who achieves anything in life with a sort of a fair amount of facility, we expect to be able to just sit and, okay, bam, sweet, I'm meditating. It doesn't work that way. It's much more like learning an instrument. Imagine if I sat you down at a piano and I basically took out a piece of Mozart and you'd never played before and I said, play. You'd think I was an idiot, right? I can't do that. It's going to take me years to be able to play that or months to just become fundamentally proficient at it. It's the same thing with this practice. Any of the meditative practices, it takes practice over time. Now, what we know is that this really simple practice, I sit for 20 minutes a day. It's really simple practice of just sitting there and observing my breath. 20 years ago, if I had brought this up in any sort of legitimate form, I would have been laughed out of the room. Now, people are begging for this. I'll go and stand before Fortune 100 companies with leadership teams from, you know, flying in from around the globe and talk about it and then guide them through. You know, they're sitting there with their Dockers and their jackets and, you know, doing this thing together. And they're loving it. And the reason is, the big shift here is that in those 20 years, there is now a huge body of peer-reviewed, published research that shows how powerful these practices are on two levels. One, they dramatically change mood and mindset. They elevate mood. They are tremendous at working with anxiety and depression, grumpiness, frustration, anger. One of the things that we know about all of those things that I just shared is they have an inverse correlation with creativity, innovation, insight-based problem solving, all of the things that you need to build anything great. So not only does it make us much calmer, does it allow us to handle that sort of baseline feeling of unease that we feel when we go to a place of uncertainty, it handles that beautifully. It also, it's like tapping a creative vein. So if you're sitting there, if you're somebody who's like, you know, you're just waiting for insights to drop from heaven, and you can't, like, you know there's something right there, but you can't see it. You can't feel it. You know it's there, but you can't get it. You're trying to work through some code. You're trying to build, like, an organization. There's a marketing approach or some paradigm that you just can't quite grasp it. One of the most powerful things that you can do is stop trying to grasp it and actually create a sitting practice where you completely remove your thoughts from that. There's now, like, an emerging body of research on that, which shows that the biggest insights. There are two ways to solve problems, by the way. Analytically and insight-based. Anyone know the difference between the two? Okay. So I'll rephrase it a little bit. Analytically is when you come to a solution and if somebody says, how'd you get there, you can work them back through the steps. This is how I got it. There's an analysis. Insight is literally the exact opposite. It's when it's the strikes of lightning. It's the and insight-based problem solving is generally the paradigm-changing version of problem-solving. It generally comes up with solutions and ideas that are far more powerful and create bigger shifts than pure analytic. You need both. But the big breakthroughs usually come when you stop working, when you work really hard, you reach literally a point of frustration where you just can't do it anymore, then you pull back. The more you create these practices like mindfulness, a daily practice, the more you create those opportunities also for amazing insights to arise. I cannot tell you how many business ideas and solutions and relationships have literally come to me when I'm sitting in the morning for 20 minutes. Mind-blowing. To the extent where I've had arguments with my meditation teacher because I want to write them all down. I want to, like, sit there and meditate and film myself or, like, have a voice recorder there and be able to just, can I just cheat for, like, 5 seconds? Okay, this is really good, blah, blah, blah. I've actually talked to developers about creating a meditation timer app that has a voice-activated feature on it so that while I'm meditating, right, I can just, it'll be completely silent, but if I say like 3 words, it'll record it so I can go back to it. Because the ideas that come to me in those windows are so powerful. So that's one practice that I want you to just sort of play with. You can find, I'm not going to go a whole lot deeper into it because there's a ton of information on how to build this practice online. You guys know about the online world, right? Sweet. There are places I go where the answer to that is, huh? So check out Jon Kabat-Zinn. Check out the UCLA Mindfulness Center also. There's a lot of sort of free resources out there, too. The second thing is something called reframing. So this is the popular word for it. Cognitive behavioral therapists have a much fancier word for it. They call it cognitive reappraisal because when you're charging $200 to $300 an hour, you have to have fancier words. It's the law. So what is it? Really simply, when we all go to that place where we're trying to create something big and we don't know how it's going to end, then we tend to ask ourselves a question that allows us to tell a story that shuts us down because then we feel better about not taking the risk. And the question we ask is what? What's the question we tend to always ask? What's the point? That's kind of a bigger life question there. Why am I here? The question we tend to ask is, what if I fail? What if I fail? The only answer you're going to get to that question is a scenario that stops you from taking action. That's the only reason to ask that question, if that's the only question you ask. Now, that's an important question to ask. And I'm going to say, ask that question, but add something to it. 3 other questions. What if I fail? Paint that picture. Write a storyline. And then add, how will I recover? Because what most of us realize is that almost everything is recoverable. I'm just like, a flash came into my mind when I said that. Flying here, I stopped over in Memphis. We had horrendous weather, maybe the worst flight I've ever been on. The plane was like, you know, like the runway is here and the plane is coming in like this. And as like it all started, the flight attendants were silent the whole time, except for 2 short bursts. One, we're flying and the plane is all over the place. Everyone's turning green. Flight attendant gets on, Michelle! Nothing else. 10 seconds later, all over the place. Oh my God! Okay, isn't it like in flight instructor, like manual, like the one thing you don't ever say, no matter what on the plane, is that? Retraining, definitely in order. So that was an interesting storyline she was telling us. So what do we add? What if I fail? Important to actually do that, but then how will I succeed? Create that scenario. Then two other questions. What if I do nothing? If I do nothing, what most people will find is the answer to that question is the scariest of anything. Because if you're sitting there and you're not content with where you are in your business, in your life, in your art, in your craft, whatever it may be, there's no sideways. There's only a slow downhill slide. There is no sideways in life. It doesn't exist. It's a myth. So if you're not happy now, a month, 12 months, a year, 5 years, 10 years out, if you just keep doing the same thing, you're really not going to be happy. The reality of the sideways scenario is pretty horrifying for most people. Paint that storyline. That becomes not a paralyzing storyline, but that becomes a mobilizing storyline. And then finally, the big one, which is, what if I succeed? And paint that storyline. What we've now done is given us alternative storylines. So we're not just fixated on this one, what if I fail? We've largely disempowered that because we've bolted on the how will I recover story to that. And we're like, oh, it's going to suck for a little bit. It's going to hurt, but I'll deal with it. In my yoga company, 2 years into it, we actually went through the entire process of franchising. Evil process, by the way. A lot of money, legal fees, registering states. We tested it out, and we tested a couple of franchises in Utah and New York. And I pulled the plug after a year because I realized I was not happy with the model, and it was going to be a brutally hard business to scale that way. I was out a lot of money. I was out a whole bunch of prestige. I was mortified. Somehow, ended up okay. 2 years later, all the money was paid back. Our studio was back on track, humming like crazy, and we continued to be rated at the top center in New York, and probably one of the highest grossing in the country. So it's recoverable. It was not fun to go through. And here's the other thing with the recovery scenario. Has anybody flamed and then come back from anything significant? He's like, maybe. And I'm kind of working on the coming back part now. What you learn when you do that is that you become incredibly empowered. What you learn is that, number one, going through a big explosion and a recovery arms you in a way that you would have never been armed had you just succeeded all the time. It teaches you how to deal with all sorts of questions that never come up when everything's going well. So it's a powerful experience, not a fun experience, but from an entrepreneur, from a creator's experience, it is a very powerful experience to have. So what we do is we have the scenario, and we have now have the ability to disempower the failure scenario and to recreate possibility scenarios and let those become the focus of what we do. And as I interviewed everyone from, you know, like multi-billion dollar CEOs to painters to people in literally every sphere, what I found was that a lot of the people who really created and performed at the highest levels did this. Many of them didn't realize what they were doing. They didn't do it intentionally, but they did this same process. And it was incredibly empowering. And we now know that there's actually a neurological basis for why it works. So fMRI studies show that, remember I talked about the fact that when we go into this uncertainty space, the amygdala, the fear center lights up and takes control and makes us want to run. We now know that when you reframe intelligently the prefrontal cortex, the seat of self-regulation, willpower, control, cognitive thought begins to light up and is able to take control, to tamp down the fear centers. So that process of reframing literally creates a chemical and electrical change in the way that your brain is functioning. So the big message is that we have to go to that place. You know, so what most of us do is as soon as we feel it, we want to run. And if I can have you guys take away anything from this, it's that if you want to create anything great, if you don't want to just rip off what the next person is doing and tweak it, if you want to actually do something stunningly cool, then you have got to go to that place where you don't know how it's going to end. Not every day, not with everything what you do, but there will be these crux moves. There will be these pivot points, these moments in time along the creation journey where you have to go there. You have to go there. You cannot create anything great without going there. It is not going to be comfortable. But there are practices that you can build over time that will give you far more equanimity when you go there and experience far less suffering. So explore those practices. And whatever you do, whatever is inside of you that needs to get out, do it. Bring it to the world. Because we are in a place now where the world needs it like never before. So, thank you. If you guys have questions, we have, are we too late for questions?
Well, actually, we've got time for questions, so.
Yeah, I think I'm supposed to be out for a signing at whatever time,
okay.
But yeah.
Yeah, so when we wrap up here, so you guys can keep going.
Cool. By the way, I have a visual reframe, and I've started showing this since Pam's in the audience. She's seen it before. But I started carrying this with me when I gave a talk at a World Domination Summit last summer, and it's become something cool. And whenever I do something like this, whenever I do anything where I have to go out there, and I'm not, you know, I love speaking, but like most people, it also freaks me out. So when I go there, I generally don't bring a lot of notes, if any notes at all, but I bring one thing. And this is the heart that my daughter drew for me in June of last year. And she gave it to me before I left, and she's like, "This is, keep this, and you'll be okay." So I bring this up here because the moment I see that, doesn't matter what happens in the room. Doesn't matter. That's what matters to me. That's my reframe. So it doesn't even have to be a set of questions now. It's just, it's a glance, and I'm good. Questions? Yeah.
That's one.
So his question was, other than going through the questions, is there an instant way you can sort of like create an instant reframe? And what's kind of interesting is what some people will do is they'll ask those questions and they'll meditate, they'll do mindfulness, and they may listen to music. There are all sorts of potential quick state-changing things that you can do. So we've just talked about a couple of them. There are actually a lot more things, you know, that you can do. And so you kind of experiment with what are the things that allow me to stay changed. There's a horribly embarrassing thing I'm going to share with you. When I was in law school, I was really driven to do well. And so, and the first year of law school, your entire grade is based on one test. And in are there any lawyers or recovering lawyers in the room? Okay. The first year of law school is when you have this opportunity to make law review. And which is generally the top 10%. And whether you make it or not follows you your entire career. It determines almost so many things. It's bizarre. So I was really into like trying to get myself in the best mental state possible before every test. So this is going to date me. So before every test, I would close the door in my bedroom and I'd study like crazy. But then for like a half an hour before, I'd put on my headphones and my like old Walkman and I'd put on George Michael's Freedom 90.
I love it.
Bam, instant state change. I don't suggest anybody else doing that. Now I'm more likely to do like AWOL Nation Sale. That kind of gets me there really quickly. But yeah, you can do it. You know, eventually, like you can find other ways to create a much more sort of instant state change. And the more you develop a practice over time, the easier it is to anchor certain images or sounds or things like that to that state change, where you actually don't need to go through the process anymore. You need to just see that thing. Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, so here's a couple, and the question was, for anyone who didn't hear it, mindfulness has become fairly mainstream these days. There's a ton of stuff out there on it. It's well-researched. It's really validated. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if I'm a room of people that they're actually going to do anything with it. So how do you get people to do it? They're simple steps. There are a lot of programs out there which are really stripped down, non-dogmatic. You don't have to buy into anything except a very gentle process. Jon Kabat-Zinn kind of was the one who really brought it mainstream, probably going on 20 years ago now. Where he brought together, he basically created an 8-week program that was called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. If you just Google Zinn's name, you can find that actually the CDs that were used, because people would just listen to a CD, it would be guided. They would do it every day, and it was guided. And so they would meet once a week, and then they would just listen to this CD once a week at home every day and progress like that for 8 weeks. And the metrics on the changes in their physiology and their mindset in 8 weeks was pretty stunning. And that's now been licensed out to hundreds of centers around the world. And that program has been replicated, you know, tens of thousands of times. You can gain access. If you look for Jon Kabat-Zinn online, you'll pull up his website, gain access to the whole. You can either find a local program, because they're all over the place now. And I like that because it's probably the most medically studied program, and there's no dogma or ideology attached to it. It's really a very stripped down thing. I'm actually probably a more of a spiritually based person, so I like to wrap some of my own beliefs around it. But you certainly don't have to buy into anything to do it. The other thing is, it's UCLA, is, I always blank on the exact name of it. There's a mindfulness center that has really similar set of recordings, MP3s, on a website for free that you can download. If you just Google UCLA Mindfulness Center, you'll find the page. And it's a similar set of things. But here's a third thing, which can be really, really, really important. And this is in any, because what we're talking about is developing a new habit here. And one of the most powerful things that we now know about habit formation are two things, really. A, do not try and create multiple habits, substantial habits, at one time. Our brain cannot handle it. It's one at a time. So if you're trying to lose weight, if you're trying to finish a book, if you're trying to exercise, don't try and now add this to it. You will almost guaranteed fail at all of them. Second is, social support is incredibly powerful as a tool to help build a new habit. So if there's like either a partner or a friend or a husband or wife or boyfriend and girlfriend, or just a group that can meet once a week, it will be your likelihood of actually building this practice will be far higher. Is that helpful to you? Yeah, and you don't have to. And actually, the MP3 is on the UCLA page. Are like they're about half the length of Zinn's ones. Also, some of them are short as like 5 or 10 minutes. So you drop them on your whatever listening devices, and it's really easy to guided versions make it really easy. Also, rather than just trying to sit there and focus on your breath, which takes some practice. Yeah, love that. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and a great fun UI on that website also. Yeah, the website is called, is it headspace.org or headspace? I don't think it's, yeah, because it's not the .com from what I remember, Headspace. It's kind of cool, and they have a whole bunch of free downloadable stuff on there. And it's actually, what's kind of cool about them, especially for this group, is that they've created kind of like a modern, fun, really engaging UI around a practice which is thousands of years old. So it's kind of neat to see how they've done it.
Yeah.
So what he was saying was that he combines swimming with this practice as a way, and like a sort of breathing, a breath-focused swimming, and that's what a lot of people do. It's a form of moving meditation. I haven't seen a lot of research on how sort of like the net changes between moving meditation versus a sitting practice compare, but I know even in the tradition that I'm most drawn to, which is Shambhala Buddhism, you alternate between sitting and walking and being sort of like, it's not necessarily about sitting, it's about bringing a very focused awareness to what you're doing. The breath just happens to be a really easy medium that's kind of universal to focus on. But yeah, it's a great example. Yeah. Yep. I don't know enough about it to be able to comment intelligently on it. But it's a great question. Any other questions? Thoughts, ideas, anecdotes, stories? Dinner. Love it. Awesome.
Thanks, man.
Awesome. It's awesome. Pleasure. Anybody else? Cool. Well, I am apparently going to be out around the corner signing books and giving hugs, and I'm a huggy person. Don't ask. I was raised by like a hippie mom and a psychologist dad, so. So thank you guys. Awesome. Enjoy the rest of the time.
Nice to meet you. David Richardson.
Hey, good.